away.
Hello and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Eduardo Jordan, coming to you from Radio 4EB in Brisbane. And today on the show,
what we've seen is a stronger interest from primary healthcare practitioners, from GPs, wanting to be a part of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health.
A new report shows more GPs are willing to learn more about Aboriginal cultural practices. We investigated more. Also, why the Wallabies added Aboriginal art on their new jerseys. And later today,
through the works of art, we're able to learn about artists' connection to the places where they live and to gain a deeper, richer understanding of those places and locations across the country.
The Tarnandi Arts Festival in Adelaide is open and better than ever. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up today, Australia is in the spotlight because of its climate change commitments without a clear strategy to reduce carbon emissions by 2050. A new report released this week by Oxfam Australia and ActionAid Australia revealed our government needs to double its climate finance to aid those countries already experiencing a climate crisis. I asked climate justice strategic lead at Oxfam Australia, Melissa Punkras, what the report entails.
The Fair Futures report is being authored by Oxfam Australia as well as with our partners ActionAid Australia and a number of other members of the Climate Action Network Australia. And the aim of this report is really to provide a roadmap for the Australian government to increase its ambition around Australia's international climate finance. So climate finance is a really important part of what has been agreed through the Paris Agreement, the International Climate Agreement, and we're basically asking for the government to increase their ambition in achieving their fair share of climate finance towards this. So Australia's heading to the COP26 Climate Summit next week, and its current commitment around climate finance is actually not at the same scale meeting the commitments of other wealthy countries, particularly those we usually compare ourselves to, such as the UK and the US. So this report really lays out a path for Australia to become a leader in climate finance once again. And the key ask in this report is for Australia to immediately double its current commitment on climate finance to $3 billion, and this is over a period from 2020 to 2025.
We know Australia has committed to reduce carbon emissions by around 2050. I mean, there's not a plan, a strategic plan at the moment, but do you think this is enough for at-risk countries?
There hasn't been a commitment yet by the government, but as you know, this is a very dominant discussion in Australia at the moment around this 2050 net zero commitment or target. But from Oxfam's perspective, we don't really feel that this is something that is enough, particularly for those countries that we know that are experiencing climate change and are bearing the brunt of the impact of climate change. So Oxfam really believes that the government needs to be more focused on the near-term targets. So you may have heard about the 2030 targets, and we really believe that the government needs to step up its 2030 targets if we are actually going to keep the warming of the planet below 1.5 degrees, which is what the Paris Agreement is aiming for.
Now, what other tasks do you believe the Australian government can do to prevent a catastrophe in those countries at risk?
For our neighbouring countries, like those countries in the Pacific in particular, and also our neighbouring countries to the north in Southeast Asia, I think they're really bearing the brunt of climate impacts. And as I said, that 2050 target is just not enough. If Australia is not reducing its emissions quickly, I think what our report really says is that it also needs to be thinking about how it can significantly increase its climate finance to help those countries and communities who are particularly at risk and are facing impacts already to adapt area that the government needs to step up.
Oxfam believes the climate crisis is a matter of human rights. Could you please expand on that statement?
Oxfam's already seeing the impact of the climate crisis in the countries and the communities we work with. And some of the things we're seeing are those kind of extreme weather-related events like tropical cyclones, droughts and floods, and as I mentioned, also sea level rise. And that's destroying people's homes, it's destroying people's livelihoods, and sometimes they're experiencing these impacts over prolonged periods. So Oxfam really recognises there was a World Bank estimate that looks at the climate crisis and says that it could drive a further 122 million people into extreme poverty by 2030, which is just incredible. And we're already seeing some of the impacts in places like the Solomon Islands, where some of the communities we work with are seeing sea level rise, already impacting on farmers' ability to grow crops. There's salt water that's intruding on land, and land that was once fertile is now incapable of growing basic food crops. As well as that, many of these same communities in the Solomon Islands are also still recovering from the impacts of Tropical Cyclone Harold in 2020. So they are also experiencing a number of climate disasters at once in one time. So I guess as you can see, that link between the climate crisis and human rights is really clear to us.
Okay, great. Now the $1 million question here. What do you think it will take for Australia to be a leader in renewable energies and in carbon emissions reduction?
Yeah, it is the $1 million question, but I think there are some really tangible things the Australian government can be doing right now. And the first one would be, as we've already talked about, the government really needs to set some ambitious emissions reduction targets. So Oxfam is supporting a 75% reduction in emissions by 2030. As I said, that 2030 target is critical. The second one I just wanted to highlight is another one the government can really take action on, is around fossil fuel subsidies. We don't need any more fossil fuel subsidies. We don't need to continue to subsidise this sector, and we don't need any new coal in Australia.
That was Climate Justice Strategic Lead from Oxfam Australia, Melissa Buncras.
Across Australia, you're listening to The Wire, Community Radio's national current affairs program.
A new report released today by the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners shows the strengths and the opportunities for the health system in Australia to become stronger. It also found out more GPs would like to work with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities and an increase of Aboriginal GPs. But it also found it needs to be appropriately funded to make this happen, especially during a pandemic. I asked Chair of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Health at the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners and Graduate Man, Professor Peter O'Mara, what the report is about.
So the State of the Nation report is a report that links in a lot of health matters across the country, and you know, we've particularly been concerned and interested in the parts about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health. And what we've seen is a stronger interest from primary health care practitioners, from GPs, wanting to be a part of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health. And I think that's a huge positive outcome for us, because a lot of our services across the country and a lot of our communities and people aren't necessarily getting the services that they require. So I think that's a huge step forward.
So what are the needs the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities have when visiting a GP?
Well, I think that's points out, I suppose, the challenge to start with. The Medicare system in itself rewards 5-minute medicine, but if you do good quality medicine, which involves spending time with your patients, then it doesn't reward the practitioner financially as anywhere near as much. And we know that most of our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people unfortunately have multi-comorbidities. So they have lots of things going on in their life around health. Yeah, they might have lots of concerns about loved ones and family members that they want to talk to their doctor about, and a whole host of things. You know, exposure to traumas even. You know, people are often exposed to racism on a daily basis, and we know that that has huge health implications. So the health matters that people present with are much more complex than what you would expect in a standard visit to a GP.
Now, one of the things of the report, they mentioned that it's important to fund appropriately Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders community, the healthcare system. How important it is to continue funding Aboriginal medical services across the country, particularly with the ongoing pandemic?
Yeah, well, look, I think, as I mentioned, that five-minute medicine in primary health care is rewarded and the quality medicine isn't. And Aboriginal medical services are renowned for doing the quality medicine. They spend time with their patients. They discuss all the issues that are on their minds. They address all the health matters in a way that you might not expect to get addressed when you go and see a GP. So that takes time. I think the funding, I think, has changed for Aboriginal medical services over a long period of time. That funding is more attached to projects and those kinds of things. When, you know, and while that's great to have that, I think the funding needs to be increased for just the general everyday stuff that we do, spending time with our patients and making a positive improvement in the life of our patients, families and communities. And I think, you know, that's probably never been more important than the situation that we're in with COVID now. You know, a lot of people are suffering increased mental health loads from that, not seeing families. Unfortunately, you know, people have loved ones who are in hospital that they can't visit. They have loved ones in ICU that they can't visit. And even, unfortunately, people have loved ones who pass away and you can't be with them. And yeah, so you know, normally if we have someone who we know is passing, we would gather and you know, many people would be around that patient and the people share the love and the thoughts of that person. So we're outside of those normal things that we do. So that's challenging. And, you know, normally Aboriginal medical services are incredibly good at having high immunisation rates. It's one of the things that we do really well. But I think, unfortunately, because of a lot of the scaremongering and the information that's put out there that is not true and correct, people start to believe that, and people haven't taken up the vaccination rates in some communities the way that we would like them. Many communities are doing amazing jobs. You know, some are in 90-94% vaccinated, which is incredible. That's where we need to be. But, you know, some, I was just talking to someone a while ago who said that one community only has 25% double dosed.
And also, I guess it plays an important part on this vaccination rollout, the misinformation that it's going to remote communities as well?
Yeah, that's right. One of the things that we have seen in many communities is that when the Indigenous leadership in the community are informed and have those conversations with the right people about the vaccines, and if they value that and they can debunk a lot of the myths, then those communities tend to have higher vaccination rates, which is really important. So it looks like, you know, we've got to have health professionals spending time with the elders and the leaders in communities to get them empowered to help the community make better decisions.
That was Weera Juriman and Chair of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Health at the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners, Professor Peter O'Mara. You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Eduardo Jordan in Brisbane. A big hello to our listeners in Alice Springs on ACCC 102.1 FM, to our friends in Hornsby, New South Wales on Triple H 100.1 FM, and to the other side of the country to Radio Gulari in Broome, Western Australia. An opportunity to embrace culture, country and art, the Tarnandi Arts Festival has opened once again in Adelaide. A celebration of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander art from all over the country, the festival spans from the middle of October until the end of January. With both in-person and online exhibitions, Tarnandi is an annual opportunity for Australians to embrace and learn about the land and cultures we inhabit. Artistic director Nikki Compston has been involved with the Tarnandi Festival for many years, and she spoke to The Wire's Ayla Liebenberg about the significance of the event.
It's a platform for artists to be able to present their work through either the exhibition at the Art Gallery of South Australia or at one of the partner organisations across the city and state. And this year at the Art Gallery, we have artists who are presenting works, paintings by many different artists from the Central Desert, from the Western Desert, as well as artists from Northeast Arnhem Land, And then we have sculptural works. We also have the work of John Prince Siddon, who's a Walmajari artist from Fitzroy Crossing, who's painted onto Boab nuts, onto a bullock skull. He was a stockman.
So what are some of the issues and themes and experiences that are being explored through some of the various works of art?
With John Prince Siddon, he is talking about, he's got a really strong social conscience and he's aware of things that are happening around the world and is painting, for example, about the bushfires on Kangaroo Island and his concern for the lives of the animals that were lost and, of course, the people as well. There are also other themes of water. Ilda Nadara, Many Hands Art Centre, and they've created a room telling the story of the Koparilia Springs and the pipeline that ran from the spring into the community of Hermannsburg. So all of these artists are descendants of Albert Namatjira and his contemporaries, and they've created a room that's sharing the story about the making of the pipeline and referencing back to a boomerang that Albert carved and then painted with the story of the men building the pipeline.
There's quite a significant lack of understanding and knowledge in the general population regarding country, culture and history prior to colonisation. So how do you think Indigenous art helps bridge this gap in understanding?
Through the works of art, we're able to learn about artists and their connection to the places where they live and to gain a deeper, richer understanding of some of the importance of some of those places and locations across the country. Some of the artists are talking about their tukapa, their ancestral creation story. And so through the paintings and the works of art, you're able to learn about their deep cultural connection to their country. For example, in the work of Yarachi Young, who's painting about the Jala tukapa. So the Jala are the honey ants. And these paintings are really large scale, beautiful, incredible, immersive works that are showing all of the under.
Keys to a floating city. You're listening to 2SER 107.3 FM, DAB, on demand, live stream, and app.
It's all got a reason, but I'm calling bullshit on that. And what's wrong with feeling sad? I would rather be than feel nothing real, real inside of me. I just wanna be.
Thank you. Life has thrown us some shit, but I promise we'll get through it. I got you, you got me. That's a hell of a team. They'll see. We won't quit. We won't quit. They can count on it. Hey, I don't know about you, but I honestly do believe that we grow when we bleed. We get stronger with every hit that we take. It's a feat, we won't cave. No defeat, we stay brave. And our love is on.
This must be the place for bookworms.
You have to remember that a worm, with very few exceptions, is not a human being.
Subscribe to 2SER for Radiothon 2021, and you can choose to go into the draw for the Bookworms prize pack. It's got a selection of new Aussie novels, vouchers for cool glasses from Dresden Vision, writing courses from Faber Writing Academy, subscription to the Saturday Paper, Adventure Writer magazine, a gift voucher to Cassula Powerhouse, dinner for two at the Atomic Beer Project, and a case of Atomic Beer to boot. Subscribe and choose your prize pack now at 2SER.com.